Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekday mornings at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and I'm glad you're listening today. This hour, the Supreme Court will hear arguments on a Mississippi abortion case. What's at stake? The law, passed by Mississippi lawmakers with an eye to the highest court, bans most abortions after 15 weeks. Their decision to consider it comes after the court struck down Louisiana's restrictions, and Chief Justice John Roberts was the deciding vote. Two guests today with insight on the implications of the law and how the conservative justices on the court may view the opportunity it provides. But we have space for your questions, too. What do you want to know about what this law may mean for Roe v. Wade? What do you want to know about the politics and the pressures that the justices will feel? We'll talk about that. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. You can tweet me at CarrieNPR. Mary Ziegler is with us, a professor of law at Florida State's College of Law and the author of Abortion in America, A Legal History, Roe v. Wade to the Present, with us from Santa Rosa Beach, Florida. Professor Ziegler, welcome back to the show. It's good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me.
Adam Liptak is with us. He's a reporter for the New York Times, where he covers the Supreme Court, and he's been writing about this decision to take the case with us from Washington, D.C. Adam, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
It's great to be here.
I want to ask you about the court's decision and the article that you wrote in which you quoted Nancy Northrup for the Center for Reproductive Rights. And she said to you, this Mississippi case was a, quote, test case to overturn Roe v. Wade. Now, we've heard that before from abortion rights advocates. Is this time different?
It sure is. The court has incurred occasional challenges to restrictions on abortion clinics, to restrictions on who can perform abortions, to distinct abortion procedures. But it has not heard a direct assault on the framework established first in Roe v. Wade since 1992, really. And this statute in Mississippi is a calculated direct assault on Roe and an invitation for the court to rethink entirely the constitutional framework for abortion rights. So while there can be alarmism among abortion rights supporters in some situations, that alarmism is entirely justified from their perspective in this case.
I noticed you use the word calculated, and I noted in the introduction that when Mississippi lawmakers were debating this, there was an eye to it appears that they wanted this to be taken up by the U.S. Supreme Court. Is that right?
Yeah, that's one way to put it. Another way to put it is that we have established constitutional law, which they should have known, did know, prohibits just this kind of law, which was struck down by the lower courts under binding Supreme Court precedent. So they knew that what they were doing was at odds with Supreme Court precedent. And the only reason to pass such a law is in the hope that the Supreme Court, and particularly a Supreme Court with a change in personnel, is going to take a different view of the law than the one that's been established for decades.
Now, we'll come back to that change in personnel. Professor Ziegler, I want to ask you about reading terms like pre-viability. It appears that that's going to be important to the court's consideration of constitutionality. Will you tell us what to be listening for as we get closer to these arguments?
Absolutely, yeah. So if the court, Adam's absolutely right that for the court to uphold this Mississippi law, it would either have to overturn all of Roe v. Wade or overturn part of Roe v. Wade. Put viability second week of pregnancy. Of course, Mississippi
Professor Ziegler,
15 weeks.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm afraid we're getting interruption on your line. I think we'll try to dial in again. How about if we do that? I don't want to miss what you have to say about this. So let's do that. I'll talk to Adam for a little bit further. Adam, maybe I'll throw that question at you. Understanding why pre-viability is going to be important in the way the court considers this, what should we know?
Well, the Supreme Court, and not everyone is satisfied with this line drawing, has picked the line of viability. That is, the ability of the fetus to survive outside the womb as the cutoff for what states can do about abortion. And what the court has said is that you can regulate in certain ways abortion before viability, but you can't ban it. And what Mississippi has done is said, but we want to ban it well before viability, which most people think is at about 23 or 24 weeks of gestational age. We want to make it 15 weeks. And if there's a justification for 15 weeks, and this is deeply contested, it's the idea that the fetus is capable of feeling pain at that time. Again, that's not widely accepted in the medical community, but that's the argument. So the framework of Roe v. Wade and an important successor case, Casey against Planned Parenthood, say that states can't ban before viability, and this law and many other laws around the nation picking different times, 6 weeks, 12 weeks, here 15 weeks, seeks to undermine the basic core distinction that Roe and successor cases have sought to draw.
Okay, so Professor Ziegler, I think you're back on the phone here. I hope the line's better.
Yeah,
good.
I should, hopefully.
You were saying, please continue, and then I have a question.
Sure, yeah. So I think viability, obviously, as Adam was saying, has been a key part of the abortion framework really since 1973. It's been one of the few things the Supreme Court really hasn't tinkered with beyond the idea that there's a basic right to choose. But it's also been seen by the anti-abortion movement as a potential weakness really since the 1980s, because the date of viability, of course, can change as technology shifts, and because some bioethicists and philosophers have argued against viability as an appropriate dividing line. But it would be a big deal, of course, if the court eliminates viability, because, of course, the question would become, if viability is not the line, then what is? Is it fetal pain at 15 weeks? Is it a fetal heartbeat at 6 weeks, as Texas would have it? Is there any limit at all, right? So there's a sort of Pandora's box quality to this kind of question, even if the Supreme Court demurs and doesn't overturn Roe entirely.
You just alluded to this, but I want to follow on it. You said medical technology has contributed to these different ideas and arguments about when fetal viability occurs. How much will that part of this matter as the if this is something that the justices are going to focus on?
Well, I think you're going to see that being a kind of key point that anti-abortion lawyers are going to lean on, essentially saying that viability is not a concept that judges and lawyers really are best equipped to handle, that this is something that looks more like something left to, as they would put it, scientific review boards than to the interpretation of the Constitution. So the fact that viability changes is going to be presented to the justices as a reason to get rid of viability. And of course, getting rid of viability would also obviously set the stage for a later decision overturning Roe outright. So I think Adam is right that the stakes of this case are really hard to overstate, even if this is not the single case where the court announces that Roe v. Wade is gone.
Yeah. And so, Adam, let's come back to that. If we are seeing a multi-step, you know, case, different cases towards overturning Roe v. Wade, it sounds like you're saying this is if indeed they go with the Mississippi law, maybe you'll use the right language there, this is going to be a very important step on what might ultimately be upending Roe v. Wade. Characterize this for us, would you?
Yeah, so Mary's quite right that in undermining the framework of Roe, they really set the stage for doing away with Roe entirely. But I'm willing to go further and say that it's not out of the question that this is the case in which they overrule Roe and tell states that they can do whatever they wish in the area of abortion.
Wow.
That the Constitution has nothing to say about abortion, and that if red states want to ban it entirely, they can. And if blue states want to have let anybody have abortion at any phase in a pregnancy, they can. So really, the stakes are quite high. A more likely outcome is they say there's nothing wrong with 15 weeks, noting that the vast majority of abortions take place before 13 weeks, that in Mississippi itself, the sole clinic itself only does abortions through 16 weeks. So we're just going to tinker a little bit with the line and say this particular line is okay. And in later cases, we'll look at whether 12 weeks or 6 weeks is okay. But once you do away with viability, which is, it's certainly not an ideal way to draw the line, for the reasons Mary was sketching out, but it's really hard to know what the alternative is. And once you do away with viability and don't have an alternative, it really leaves open road toward the idea of saying that states which wish to ban abortion entirely can do so.
I've got the New York Times site up here, your publication, of course, and you have this excellent map where abortion access would decline if Roe v. Wade were overturned. I want to understand this. There are, of course, big areas of the United States that sweep from certain areas up in the north and sweep through the southern part of the United States and go over into Texas. Is the belief here that the Graf here is calling these trigger laws and others deemed likely to ban abortion? I mean, is this an indication that we would be headed for a country where there are states you couldn't get an abortion, you can cross a state line, and you can get an abortion? Is that what both of you, I want to ask you each this, is that what both of you think we are ultimately headed for? Adam, why don't you tackle that first?
It's a plausible outcome. Are we headed there? Well, in earlier cases, it seemed like we might be headed there, and yet some surprising members of the court in the end came around to the view that there's a settled expectation among people that the core right in Roe should be sustained. And as recently as last year, the Chief Justice of all people, a conservative, voted with the four liberals to strike down a Louisiana abortion restriction. So nothing is set in stone. But as you say, and as that map reflects, maybe 20 states, if they were allowed to, would prohibit abortion outright. And 11 states, including Mississippi, have so-called trigger bans on the books, which would instantaneously ban abortion if Roe was overturned.
Professor Ziegler, here's something that Caitlin Knowles-Myers, an economist at Middlebury College, tells the New York Times about this map. A post-Roe United States isn't one in which abortion isn't legal at all. It's one in which there's tremendous inequality in abortion access. Will you talk to us about the implications of that?
Yeah, I think that the world that anti-abortion leaders are imagining is one in which abortion is illegal everywhere. So one thing to note is that if Roe is in fact overturned, anti-abortion lawyers will not just be satisfied with that outcome and leave things well enough alone. They will be back at the Supreme Court asking for a more absolute remedy. Now, I think Adam is right to be skeptical about whether that would work, at least in the near term. So what we're much more likely to see is a kind of variation on what's been going on in the United States for the past several decades, which is that we have a patchwork of laws and access varies really radically from state to state, even today. But of course, if Roe were gone, those differences would sharpen dramatically. So we would see some states like Alabama that might make abortion a crime punishable by 99 years in prison. We might have other states that actively reach out to make abortion accessible to people from outside of the state who would be traveling there to seek the procedure. So there would be inequalities based on certainly zip code, but also inequalities based on race and income, which we saw when abortion was a crime the last time, which we see today and which we would expect to see even more pronounced if the court were to overrule Roe.
Oh. Mary Ziegler is with us. She's a professor of law at Florida State University College of Law, and she's the author of Abortion in America, A Legal History, Roe v. Wade to the Present. And Adam Liptak is with us. He covers the U.S. Supreme Court for the New York Times and has been writing pieces most recently about the court's decision to take up this Mississippi case. I want to ask you, I'm going to share some poll numbers with our guests here, and I'm sure you they're both familiar with this, but for our listeners, a recent Reuters Ipsos poll found last year that 76% of Democrats, 61% of independents favor the idea that abortion should be legal in most cases. For our listeners this morning, are you watching this perhaps as one of those Democrats, as one of those independents? Are you watching this uneasily? What does the prospect of what we've just been talking about, states pretty much get to do perhaps what they want on abortion laws, what's the prospect of this kind of patchwork of access? What occurs to you about that? What's the prospect of that mean to you? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. You can tweet me at @CarrieMPR. Professor Ziegler, I want to ask you about this. I just talked about the numbers in those polls, and I know in some ways it depends on how you ask the question, the kind of percentages that you get back. How should we understand what Americans are saying about the legality of abortion?
Well, one of the things that makes it kind of devilishly hard is that we've come to mean so many things when we talk about Roe. Mm. So just to give you one example, President Biden has been asked over and over again, what will you do if the Supreme Court overturns Roe? And his answer is to codify Roe. And then, of course, reporters ask, well, what exactly does he mean by
that? Yeah, I saw that.
The real answer is we don't know because Roe means different things to different people. But I think if you dig deeper into the polling, what it seems to suggest is that most Americans certainly don't like the idea of laws criminalizing all abortions, particularly early in pregnancy. Most Americans are attached to the idea of Roe, large majorities, whatever they think it means, but that many Americans also seem to favor restrictions on abortion, particularly later in pregnancy. So popular opinion really doesn't look much like the kinds of positions you see staked out by pro-choice and pro-life leaders. It's much more muddled. And ironically, probably tracks relatively well the kind of ugly mess we have now where abortion is legal but restricted. I think we would expect some kind of backlash if Roe was gone, both because that would traverse that line of allowing full criminalization, and also because it would get rid of the idea that abortion is a right, which is something that does seem to poll pretty well.
Adam, the Chief Justice must surely be aware of where the American people are on this. How much does that matter, given where the locus of power now sits on the court?
A year ago, it would have mattered a lot. A year ago, he held a decisive vote. But with the replacement of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg by Justice Amy Coney Barrett, the Chief Justice has lost his power to guide the court. I am certain he did not want to take this case. It takes four votes to take a case. My strong suspicion is his vote was not among those four. He would cheerfully have turned this down. He doesn't want this fight. He doesn't think it's good for the court. He doesn't have a problem, I don't think, with cutting back on abortion rights, with hollowing out abortion rights. But a case like this, this big, this bold, is not something John Roberts has an appetite for. And there's good reason to think the court really struggled with whether to hear this case. They discussed it, quite unusual, at their private conference more than a dozen times. And I think it was a hard-fought battle about whether to put the case on the docket. But since it only takes four votes out of nine to do so, and there are now five votes to the Chief Justice's right, he clearly didn't prevail.
Just a quick follow-up before we take a call. Do you think the Chief Justice thought in the court, you know, wrangling with the Louisiana law and the Louisiana law decision coming out the way it did and the fact that he was the swing on that, do you think he thought, well, we've put that to bed for a while? Or I mean, did he even know then this isn't the end and the prospect of exactly what's happened lay before him?
It's a complicated mix of things. John Roberts is not a fan of abortion. And I don't think he has a problem with cutting back on abortion rights. The case from Louisiana was complicated because it essentially asked the same question that the court had decided in the Texas case just a few years before. And that was too much. That reversal of precedent, just because there had been a change of personnel on the court, was not something the Chief Justice could stomach. But it's quite easy to overread from that one vote where he is on abortion. And really, it's not a question about the ultimate direction of John Roberts. It's about the pace of change. And he's an incrementalist. And the big, bold step this case asked the court to take is not his preferred approach to constitutional adjudication.
Okay. Super important context there. To Erica in Faribault. Hi, Erica. Thanks so much for calling in. What are you thinking about?
Well, I'm thinking about this from the perspective of a director of a rape crisis center. And so we have clients who unfortunately have situations where they've already been traumatized. And then, you know, we've had situations where people have been assaulted in group homes. We know that people with disabilities are 7 times more likely to be victims of sexual assault. And so we've had this situation where, you know, the clients themselves, it was medically necessary. And so to think about transporting a person who has very limited resources, very limited access to a different state after our already traumatic experience, I just think about the clients that I'm serving and their access and ability to get the medical care that they need.
Yeah. You know, Erica, I don't know if you've seen this map that we were talking about on the Times site. It's really valuable. But I look at where how states, well, like Minnesota, in our neck of the woods up here in the upper Midwest, and how you could very well have a client in one of the Dakotas, right? And yeah. Who has a very, I'm sure you're thinking about that very prospect and having to bring them over some state line around those states to have access to abortion if they needed it or wanted it.
Absolutely. And that is exactly what I'm thinking about. You know, I haven't seen that particular map, but I've seen other maps similar to that. And just, again, thinking about all of our clients and the barriers that they already face, particularly with transportation, monetary barriers, and just the shame and the, you know, the isolation that so many of my clients feel. And so these are things that are always on the top of my mind.
Okay. I appreciate the call. Professor Ziegler, we got a call from Mira in St. Paul who says, this isn't about giving states the right to legislate as they want. It's about giving religious people too much power to legislate for everyone. The states' rights conversation is a euphemism. Given the fact that you've written about the history of Roe v. Wade, where does that fit in?
Well, I think certainly the states' rights argument is a little disingenuous insofar as pretty much no one in the anti-abortion movement and none of the red state legislators really want states' rights, right? They want no legal abortion, because if you believe, as they do, that a fetus or unborn child is a rights-holding person, it's utterly unacceptable that Minnesota would have legal abortion and Alabama would not, right? Any more than it would be okay if Minnesota legalized murder and Alabama did not. So I think it's right to be skeptical of states' rights arguments as anything more really than a strategy at the Supreme Court to get one step further on the road to an absolute ban on abortion, because that's the goal. It's nothing short of that would satisfy people who have, I think, both religious and moral objections to abortion.
Adam, this might seem like an obvious question, but can we look to the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg? I guess I'm asking you, where did the dominoes start to fall to bring us to this point in 2021 where the court's going to hear this case and things could really change?
Yeah, so they fall in the following way. We've long had a conservative Supreme Court, but also we've long had some justices in the middle of the court who, while generally conservative, while Republican appointees, were very cautious about abortion. So you had Justice Sandra Day O'Connor and Justice Anthony Kennedy at the middle of the court, who in a couple of cases protected the right to abortion. And then you had the Chief Justice, also a Republican appointee, also conservative, but in the middle of the court is the median justice, or some people would say the swing justice, protected the right to abortion in this Louisiana case we talked about a second ago. All of that is gone. There's no longer that kind of soft middle at the court where you have a generally conservative court being cautious on abortion rights. What you have are three Trump appointees, and President Trump, of course, vowed to appoint justices who would overturn Roe. You had supporters and senators who were confident that these three appointees would do that. You had evidence in their writing and judicial decisions that they were hostile to abortion rights. And you add that to people like Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito, who have expressed opposition to abortion rights. And it's quite easy to do the math to see that you no longer have that person in the middle, that O'Connor, that Kennedy, that Roberts, who can sort of hold the line a little bit. And that suggests that unless something surprising happens, we're going to have either a narrow or a broad decision in this case that supporters of abortion rights are going to be quite unhappy with.
Oh. Call from Barbara in Bloomington. Hi, Barbara. Thanks so much for calling in. What do you want to share with us?
Good morning. I feel very strongly about this issue. My mother was 45 years old in 1967 and had an illegal abortion in Detroit performed by a man she'd never laid eyes on in a motel room.
Oh, my.
And she ended up in the ER the next day. She survived. But in 1985, I had an abortion performed by my doctor in a hospital, and I was fine physically. I wonder how the Supreme Court can throw women back 50 years to having to deal with this ourselves, because we will, and we have in the past. And I'd also like to know what law there is on the books that regulates men's bodies the way this one regulates women's.
Barbara, I'm going to give Mary Ziegler, our law professor, and Adam Liptak, our reporter who covers the court, a bit of time to think about that. And I really appreciate the call. We'll get a look at the latest news when we come back. Our conversation with Professor Ziegler from Florida State University College of Law and Adam Liptak from the New York Times. I also want to talk with them about the role that Justice Amy Coney Barrett is going to play. Back to the conversation. Professor Ziegler, I want to come to you on what you heard as Barbara described her own family's experience with this and her concerns about where this might be headed.
Yeah, I think one thing to wonder about is what it would look like if abortion is a crime again. And I think one of the reasons we've seen so many red states focus on laws around medication abortion is that that would make it much harder for states to prevent people like Barbara's ancestors from having safe abortions, right? So there are already startups organizing to make abortion medication available. The Biden administration is poised to lift some of the restrictions on medication abortion. But of course, I think Barbara's right that for the Supreme Court, that the prospect of some people suffering due to illegal abortions won't be that compelling, because it will certainly happen even if medication abortion is available. We've seen this historically before, that people with fewer resources tend to have less access to information about how to use abortion medications or seek safe abortions, and do tend to have complications, and do sometimes tend to not seek out care after getting, if there are complications, because they fear legal consequences.
I'm really glad you brought I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say, Professor, I'm really glad you brought the question here of how the technology and the landscape of this. It's chilling to hear Barbara say that her mother went to a motel in Detroit and had an abortion by a person she'd never seen and ended up in the ER the next day. Given the fact of what you're saying about medical abortions, and given the fact that the access is pretty sophisticated in many places, we talked about what may happen if depending on the court's decision. I mean, it is going to feel quite different no matter what happens than it did in 1965, isn't it?
It is. And I think that the stakes will be especially high for places like Minnesota, because of course, before Roe, the pro-choice and pro-life movements were not nearly as well-funded or politically connected. So there's going to be untold amounts of money poured into what the law in places like Minnesota or Florida that are going to be kind of regional islands for abortion access, what the law looks like there. And technologically, it's going to be a lot harder for states to shut down abortion access. And that is going to have interesting trickle-down effects for what the law looks like in those states. So at the moment, most red states are taking the position that they will not punish women or pregnant people for having abortions. Mm-hmm. They understand that polls terribly. But as you can imagine, if we're talking about medical abortions, it's really hard to see how the state could meaningfully enforce a restriction or ban on outright ban on abortion without punishing patients. So I think that technological change could produce a legal change as well.
Adam, would you add anything to that?
No, I think Mary covered it quite well. I mean, we could easily live in a world where, as a practical matter, red states try to ban abortion entirely, but mail-order drugs could be available to allow women to have abortions using only medication. And that, as Mary sketched out, leads to really the only way to address that would be to prosecute women for ending their own pregnancies. And that is not a politically appealing answer. And in general, the consensus for the longest time has been that overruling Roe would be bad for Republicans, that Republicans should be careful what they wish for, because if that were to happen, there would be a backlash among voters and among female voters in particular. I don't know whether that remains the consensus, given the level of activity in this area. But for the longest time, you know, the sort of Karl Roves of the world were happy to campaign on doing away with Roe, but certainly didn't want it to happen.
A call here from Deborah in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Deborah. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah. I was a co-founder and co-operator of the Feminist Women's Health Center in Tallahassee, Florida. And one of our services was to provide abortions. We opened in 1974. We thought that Roe would be overturned long before now.
Yeah.
So what we did, we not only trained doctors in vacuum aspiration first trimester abortions, because they only learned DNCs in medical school and actually in emergency rooms, which is not a safe procedure. But we trained a whole lot of women through our self-help clinics because we saw this coming. And it is not a medical procedure, not in the first trimester.
Deborah,
it's actually quite simple procedure.
Did you hear, I am curious about, given your experience, did you hear what we were saying about the availability of a medical abortion? That's surely quite different than what it was like in 74 when you were doing this work in Tallahassee.
Yeah, and it's a good sign. I'm glad that's happened. But, you know, we were absolutists. We believed nobody had a right to tell a woman what to do with her body, period. Not a doctor, not a husband, nobody. So we're going to keep getting abortions. They're not going to be able to stop us. I'm 72, so I would be somebody doing abortions, but they're not going to be able to stop us. And through drugs or whatever, it's just become easier, I think, for most women to get these procedures.
I appreciate the call, Deborah. Thank you. Adam, I want to ask you about how you interpret, I'm sure you've parsed the words of Justice Coney Barrett's speeches. I want to ask you about something that she said when she gave a speech at Jacksonville University and she was asked about abortion and restrictions that states might impose. And she said, I think the core case, Roe's core holding that, you know, women have a right to an abortion, I don't think that would change. But I think the question of whether people can get very late-term abortions, how many restrictions can be put on clinics, I think that would change. Now, in light of where, again, the locus of power is on the court, how do you see what she was saying there?
I think Justice Barrett, then a law professor, was describing the state of the world at the time she was speaking and with the personnel on the court that then sat. I don't think she was sketching out her own views. Her own views, in one sense, are unknown because although we do know that as a personal matter, as a policy matter, she is personally opposed to abortion and has signed newspaper ads objecting to Roe and to abortion on demand. At her confirmation hearing, she said, as you would expect, well, I'll put my personal views to one side and I'll look at the law and do what the Constitution compels me to do. So in one sense, we don't know where she stands, but it would be the unusual justice who would have such strongly held personal views, have clerked for Justice Scalia, have endorsed his methods of constitutional interpretation, who would think there is a constitutional right to abortion. Justice Barrett says she's an originalist, mm-hmm. And I think she would say that the people who wrote and ratified the Constitution were not thinking that they were establishing a right to abortion. So I think while parsing her previous statements doesn't get you very far, taking in the totality of her approach in this area and to the law would make you think that she is very likely a vote to restrict, undermine, away with Roe.
Professor Ziegler, I don't want to let this pass because Adam used that phrase that she would say she's an originalist. We hear that a lot when we talk about these consequential court decisions and the individual justices. What does that mean, I guess, and what should Americans understand about what a justice is saying when they say that?
Well, I think there are two things to understand about what that means when it comes to Roe. So first of all, what Barrett means is that she believes that she interprets the Constitution in line with its original public meaning. Now, when it comes to abortion, that probably means that she, like lots of self-proclaimed originalists on the right, don't think there's a right to abortion in the Constitution because the right to abortion has been most closely tied to the 14th Amendment, which became part of our Constitution in the aftermath of the Civil War at a time when many states were actually criminalizing abortions for the first time. So she would say the people writing the 14th Amendment were not likely thinking about abortion at all. And if they were, they would have thought that abortion was wrong because that's what most states were doing mm-hmm. at the time. That said, though, even originalists like Barrett have argued that you usually don't overrule a past precedent just because it's wrong. Now, certainly some justices, Clarence Thomas, has taken the position that that shouldn't be the way the court does business, but most of the court's conservatives still adhere to the idea that there should be some sort of extra factor militating in favor of reversal, which is why you see anti-abortion leaders and sometimes justices hinting at things about Roe that make it particularly deserving of getting overturned. So, for example, in 2019, in a case called Box versus Planned Parenthood of Indiana and Kentucky, Clarence Thomas suggested that abortion rights were somehow rooted in racism and eugenics, suggesting that Roe then was not just wrong, but was part of a kind of problematic racist tradition in the United States. Huh. You see other arguments that Roe polarized our politics. So for all these reasons, it's not just originalism, but originalism plus something else.
I see. Call from Dan in Circle Pines. Hi, Dan. Thanks so much for waiting. What are you thinking about?
Well, I'm disturbed that the court may say some states can restrict abortions and others can't. Why does this apply to abortion? Why would they not say that other states like Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama could have poll taxes? Or in some states, you would have a right to counsel in criminal cases and others not. This seems to be setting up a different standard of rights, and I'm not sure where they would establish this basis that some rights exist in some states and not other states.
Adam?
So the baseline proposition is that states are independent sovereigns and get to do what they like unless they run afoul of federal law or a federal constitutional provision. If there is a constitutional right to abortion, then of course states can't ban it. But that only poses the question. It doesn't answer it. In many, many areas, states take different approaches to, say, the death penalty. And the court says they can have the death penalty or they cannot have the death penalty. It's their choice. And this may be one of those areas in which there's a right that extends nationwide. But if there is no such right, then states can do what they like.
Adam, I want to come back to something that Professor Ziegler alluded to earlier, which is what President Biden says when he's asked about this. I noted something that Jen Psaki said on Monday as this case was announced. She said, President Biden is committed to codifying Roe regardless of the outcome of this case. Professor Ziegler talked to us about kind of from the legal standpoint of what this means. Politically, what does that mean?
I find that approach very confusing. I don't know what the statute could say. And I'm not sure Congress has this power. I mean, Congress's power is limited by the Constitution, too. And as we saw in the Obamacare case, you have to identify a constitutional provision under which Congress can tell the states what to do. And I'm not sure one readily comes to mind. Is it the commerce power? And then, of course, the substance of the statute is a little hard to know. What would it say exactly? Congress would tell the states that they couldn't ban abortion before viability. That's an odd, surprising statute. And of course, you know, as we see in other areas, Congress is very polarized, and the chances of getting that kind of law through the current Senate are impossible.
I mean, they can't even get the infrastructure thing going. It's really hard to imagine passing an abortion bill with all the complexity that we've been talking about for the hour.
Yeah, so it's a good answer for a press secretary to give, but it may not be a practical answer to this set of problems.
All right. Amy in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Hi, Amy. Good to have you on the phone.
Hi. I am actually an OBGYN in an obviously very red state. Mm-hmm. And even though Minnesota has, they have some constitutional things that would hopefully allow abortions to continue in Minnesota, it really kind of terrifies me to think about having Roe v. Wade overturned. We already have huge abortion access issues in South Dakota with just one provider, and people on the other side of the state have to drive 6 hours and have a 72-hour waiting period that doesn't include weekends and holidays. It's ridiculous. And having had the privilege of being trained by some providers who actually practiced medicine before Roe v. Wade, I mean, I have heard horror stories about women dying of septic abortions. And I realize that with medical abortions, hopefully it wouldn't be as significant as it was in the past, where they had whole wards of women with septic abortions and those wards closed after Roe v. Wade. But I still think there's the potential for significant maternal mortality in rural areas, places without access, and it's always going to be like it always has been. Women with money and it will find a way, and women who are poor and can't take time off of work and don't have money and access to people that can help won't, and they'll be the ones that suffer the most. It's really, really horrifying to me to think that 15 miles down the road, my patients in Minnesota are going to have completely different options than my patients here in South Dakota. And it seems very un-American to have different rights in different states.
I really appreciate the call and your knowledge and experience on this. Professor Ziegler, I think you were alluding to this earlier, that what Amy is saying about people with means will have a lot more options, and that's kind of the landscape that we might be headed for.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the landscape in some ways we've always been in. It was the landscape before Roe. It's been the landscape since Roe. But I think what would change is just that the stakes would get much higher, right? So if you're someone in the Dakotas who has an illegal abortion and something goes wrong, maybe you take that abortion pill too late in your pregnancy or you don't know how pregnant you are and you need to go to the hospital, there are going to be a lot of women who don't go because they're going to think, well, if I go, will I go to prison? You know, will I go to prison for a long time? Many of these people have children already. They might not get to see their children, right? So, I mean, there's a real, I think, change anyway. So I want to both say that we already live in that world where resources make a pretty significant difference. And so does race, so does age, and so does zip code. But those differences would become much more pronounced in a world where Roe v. Wade is no longer on the books.
So, Adam, the court will hear the arguments in October, right? Which means that the decision will come out in the middle of 2022. Is that right? Probably.
Yeah, probably the court will hear it in the fall. I would guess November or December. Okay. And a case this big almost always comes out on the very last days of the court term. So we're looking at the last days of June of 2022, which means this will be right in the middle of the midterm elections. It'll make this already important issue really in the spotlight for the next election.
That's exactly what I was going to ask you about. And you were kind of talking through which way this may cut. What we do know, though, is that candidates will fundraise, political organizations will fundraise on this. Is it just from your observation of the way this goes, this will be a key issue in those midterm races?
Yes, it sure looks that way. And it's a little hard to say, and I guess it'll depend on the state, which way it will cut. I think, as the polling you and Mary discussed suggest, most people are uncomfortable with the idea of doing away with abortion rights entirely. And because that's a realistic prospect in this case, or at least a significant step in that direction in this case, that'll make the politics of this quite salient.
Adam, we know you're really busy, and we really appreciate the hour. It's a long time, but wow, I know we benefited from your knowledge and experience. Thank you.
Real pleasure to be here.
Professor Ziegler, same to you. I know you're busy. You have a lot going on. Really grateful for your time and expertise. Thank you.
It was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
Mary Ziegler is a professor of law at Florida State University College of Law, and she is the author of Abortion in America. Adam Liptak covers the Supreme Court for the New York Times, and you've probably been reading, as I have, his articles on the meaning of the decision of the court to take up this Mississippi case. Tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., as I've said, it's been a long time since we've talked about the housing market. It's on fire. If you're trying to buy a house, what should you know? If you're selling, what should you know? If you feel like you're being priced out of the market, boy, I've heard from a number of people that are in that situation. What should you do tomorrow morning at 9?
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. You can add your voice to the discussion by calling in at 800-242-2828 or tweeting us at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. To hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks!